Orientation to Biblical Sexual Ethics, the ninth talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 26, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center and Institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
A biblical theory of sexual intimacy. Tonight we're going to I was able to focus in on a single passage last week because I think there's a passage that teaches implicitly what I think we need to know about the nature of sexual intimacy. Tonight there won't be any particular passage because I'm going to have to try to synthesize a whole lot of the whole scope, the whole range of biblical teaching. I think, in order to answer the question of what is a biblical sexual ethic. Before I get into it, let me just make a preliminary comment. You may not have noticed, but we live in a particularly twisted culture when it comes to sexuality these days. There were times, I think, in our history where we had a much healthier view of sexuality than we do today. There have always been problems, but you younger people especially are faced with pressures and challenges that I never dreamt of. As a consequence, I think we have undoubtedly as individuals succumbed to temptations that I didn't even know were temptations when I was younger. So I'm undoubtedly going to be stepping on some toes. I'm going to be stepping on my own toes. But I think it's important that we as Christians who are seeking to understand and uphold a biblical worldview, that we not make the mistake of trying to make our biblical ethic realistic, if you understand what I mean by that. That is, we don't decide on ethical questions based on what we in fact do and how we in fact think and what we in fact want. We base our sexual ethics, or any kind of ethics for that matter, based on what's right. What's really objectively right, what's objectively good. So what I'm going to try to propose is a way of looking at ethics in general and sexual ethics in particular that conforms to really what the Bible objectively thinks is good and right and true. If our lives fall short of that, well, then our lives fall short of that. We need to face into the reality of forgiveness, the reality of the cross. I think we have a whole talk devoted to forgiveness for sexual sins, at least a talk that we'll deal with that more extensively. So I'm not going to say anything more about it here tonight, but I just want to preface this by saying I know that we've failed. I know that I have failed. I know that we live in a really, really perverse culture. But that's no reason for us to compromise our understanding of what in fact God wants from us, what in fact is true. So some of the things I'm going to say here tonight are pretty demanding, and you're going to think that's pretty conservative and that's pretty old-fashioned and it's going to get worse later rather than, if you think this talk is bad, it's going to get worse later. But I hope you will evaluate what I'm saying not pragmatically, not based on I don't like that because that doesn't make me look good, but rather by the standard of, is it really right? Is it really what the Bible actually is teaching? That, I think, is the only relevant question to ask. So before I get into the question of sexual ethics in particular, I want to try to give an overview of what I think is an approach to biblical ethics generally, not whether we're talking about sexual issues or any other kind of issues. There's some basic outlook on ethics that I think we need to understand, otherwise we can't understand the Bible's teaching on sexual ethics. The basic ethical theory of the Bible, it seems to me, in answering the question, what is evil about evil? What makes whatever we call evil, what makes it evil? I think at the heart of it, from the biblical perspective, what makes evil evil is that it involves a rebellion against or a hostility toward God, fundamentally. Everything comes down to that. We don't like God, we don't trust God, and it's our hostility, our antagonism, our resistance to God and the things of God that really is at the heart of what makes our evil evil. We're hostile toward what's good, we're hostile toward what's right, we're hostile toward what's true, we're hostile toward what's really, truly, objectively beautiful and pleasant and genuinely lovely. In all those ways, we manifest this thing that the Bible calls evil, because what's good and right and what's true and what's beautiful and pleasant and lovely all have their source in God, ultimately, and He's the one we really have a beef with. We don't much like God, naturally. So, with that in view, there may be more. I may not have captured all of them, but it seems to me that there are five things that come to mind that constitute the different aspects of evil from a biblical perspective. The first is hostility to God's character, and that, in biblical terms, is we don't love God. That is one of the marks of the child of God that gets repeatedly referred to in the Bible. Are the children of God love God? Well, what does it mean by loving God? I think basically what we would call like. We don't like God. We don't really like who God is. As we get to know Him and what makes Him tick and what His priorities are and what His values are and so on, it doesn't resonate with us. We don't really like who God is. We don't like the way He's running His universe. We don't like the way He's running our lives. Not much about Him that we like. Well, naturally, that's always our reaction to God. But as children of God, that's one of the things that in our heart, the Spirit of God comes and begins to change, begins to tweak our hearts so that we become the kind of people who our eyes are open. We begin to see how really, truly wonderful and glorious and magnificent our Creator is. He really knows what He's doing, and He's a really... this is a terrible thing to say. He's a nice guy. So anemic. But that we come to see Him, we come to like Him. We come to, in biblical terms, love Him. And we're responding to His character, to His person, to his being. His being as a person. We like Him. So that's the first thing. Evil, one aspect of evil is that we're hostile to God's character. Second thing, it seems to me, is that we're hostile to God's role. God is, after all, the Almighty God, the creator of everything, the author of everything that is, the author of our lives, the author of history, the author of all reality. He runs the whole show, and He's not asking anybody how to do it, not asking any, it's not democratic, He's not asking permission. He just is sovereign. He just is absolutely, completely the determiner of everything. In that role, we're hostile to Him having that control. We don't like it that He has that kind of control, that He has that kind of power, that He has that kind of determinative influence in our life. We don't trust Him. We're unable to just relax and let Him write the script the way He wants to write the script and have my life go the way He wants my life to go. We don't like that. And we hate Him for it, and we resist Him for it. So our lack of trust comes from this hostility to His role in reality. Third aspect, we're hostile to His character, we're hostile to His role, we're hostile to God's values, it seems to me. We disregard truth. Truth really is not that important to us. Goodness is not that important to us. Purity, whatever that is, whatever that means, is not really important to us. We kind of like, we kind of glory in, we even kind of pride ourselves at times in being compromised people, dabbling in evil, dabbling in moral compromises of one kind or another. We don't have the same sensibilities as our Creator with respect to light is light and darkness is darkness, and darkness is to be repudiated and rejected and hated and removed from our lives. It's not our perspective. Our perspective is, you know, God's just a little bit overboard there. You know, why doesn't he lighten up a little bit? And that's our natural reaction, because we don't share that. And so we have this resistance to emulate God in that regard. We have this resistance to like him for having that kind of clarity, moral clarity, about the distinction between good, light and darkness, good and evil. Hostile to his character, his role, his values, his value system. Fourth thing is, we're hostile to God's creation. And what I mean by that is, one of the things the Bible teaches is that God, as the author of all things, has created a cosmos, has created this organized, structured reality. It's not only organized and structured at the level of subatomic particles and at the level of physics and chemistry and biology, but it's structured in more complex ways. One of those ways being, for example, at the level of human sexuality. There's a purpose for human sexuality, I've been trying to argue over the past few weeks. There's a purpose for it. It has a role. It has a place in the order and structure and rational, the rational ordering of God's creation. But we're hostile toward God's rationally ordered universe. We would just as soon redo it, remake it, recreate it, have it be other than it actually is. And we really see that in our culture today with respect to sexuality. We don't want sexuality to be what God created sexuality to be. We want sexuality to be what I've decided I want sexuality to be. And to play it out and act it out and try to remake it, refashion it, recreate it into our liking. So we violate the purpose that is built into God's creation. We transgress that, we ignore that, and try to create purposes of our own for the things in God's world and God's created order. And then finally, we are hostile to God's purposes, and where that manifests itself in what the Bible calls worldliness. That is, God's purpose, God's ultimate purpose, all of God's purposes, I should say, kind of are summed up in this basic overall overarching story that God is telling, where he has created a world that was never intended to be permanent. It was never intended to be everlasting and eternal. It was intended to be a temporary stepping stone to a whole other phase of reality, a whole other qualitatively different order of reality. This was a testing ground. This was a preparation for that. And we were creatures put into this world to be prepared for the age to come, for the final age. And where should our hopes lie? Where should we sink our roots? What should be that level of reality that defines my being and my life project and my purposes and my existence? It should be by my hope in the world to come, in the final age. And yet, we rebel against that. We're actually hostile to that. That seems boring, it seems abstract, it seems removed, it seems distant, it seems irrelevant to us. We mock it as pie in the sky by and by. I have mocked it as pie in the sky by and by in my younger life, in my other life. But that was God's purpose from the get-go, is for us not to find our happiness and our satisfaction, our fulfillment here and now. As Ecclesiastes reminds us, this is all hollow and empty. This is emptiness, nothing but air, nothing but breath. There's no substance to this life here compared to what our heart longs for, compared to what God ultimately intended for us. This is insubstantial. But there is something substantial awaiting us in another age, and that needs to be the focus of our existence. But in our hostility to God and everything about him, we say, no, this is pretty okay here. I want this. I want it now. I want to be happy now. Just let me have what I want in this world, and we'll call it good. But to settle for this insubstantial emptiness of this world is evil, what the Bible calls worldliness. So in all five of those ways, hostility to God's character, his role, his values, his creation, his universe, and his purpose, we manifest our hostility to God, and that kind of covers the range of evil, I think. Now, maybe there's something I forgot there that could also be included, but at least you get a feel for, I think, the range of what the Bible is willing to call evil. So anything that involves one or more of those five different manifestations of our hostility to God, in a biblical ethical theory, it would say it is sin, it is unrighteousness, it is evil. Now I want to say something parenthetically here. I don't know where else to put it, because it doesn't, just sort of a parenthetical comment. But because we live in the day in which we live, I think it's important to recognize that the Bible does not teach what philosophers would call a consequentialist view of ethics. And let me explain what that is. Starting in around the time of the Enlightenment, and it really started formulated by a philosopher named Jeremy Bentham, and then later by J.S. Mill and other what philosophers call utilitarian philosophers. A utilitarian philosopher basically decided that if we could just simply identify what life is really all about, what makes life good, what is a unit of good, then we could decide what actions ought to be taken by calculating how many units of good are created or produced as a consequence of my action. And you kind of take everything into account, and if more units of good are created than units of bad that negate the units of good, and indeed if you can maximize the number of good units that are produced as a consequence of your action, then that action is a morally good thing to do. Well, I won't get into the whole critique of that. There's all kinds of problems with utilitarianism. It's wrong-headed, it's short-sighted, it's naive, it's unworkable. I mean, there's not much good about it, there's not much right about it. But it has prevailed that the attitude that is embodied in utilitarianism, I would argue, is the dominant ethical picture in the world today. And any system that sees judging whether or not an action is a morally right action or not, it needs to be determined by what are the consequences of the action, pure and simple, to call it, but only and merely by the consequences of action are you measuring whether an action is a good action or not. That's a consequentialist view of ethics. And my contention is the biblical view of ethics is not consequentialist. Very, very simply, what I mean by that is, from a biblical perspective, there may be things that are right. There are times when there are things that are right to do that may very well lead to very unfortunate, even tragic consequences. But, oh well. To do the right thing is to do the right thing, and the consequences need to be managed by someone else, not me. It's not my job to steer reality. That's somebody else's job. It's not my job to make sure that I protect everyone from pain and grief and agony and hurt. That's not my job. My job is to do what I have to do. My job is to do what's right. My job is to do what's good, and the consequences will ultimately be what they will be. And that's more in character with the spirit of biblical ethics than what we hip and enlightened modern people are inclined to think. This really came home to me in a philosophy journal article that I was reading. He posed an ethical dilemma, and it was so obvious to me and so striking to me that it stuck with me. He creates this ethical dilemma. You're an American tourist down in South America, and you're up high in the Andes, and there's this little village, and excuse my Spanish here, but some bandidos or something come flying into town, and they gather everybody up and bring them into the town square, and just for the sheer evil of it, just for the sheer satisfaction of making other people share in their evil, they concoct this scheme where they are going to give you, the American tourist, a gun, and they take 10 peasants and they say, if you will shoot these 10 peasants dead, then we will spare you and the whole rest of the village. But if you refuse to shoot these 10 peasants, then we're going to kill you and everybody in the village. Well, by any consequentialist, almost any, I mean, some of them get pretty complicated and pretty sophisticated, but by almost any consequentialist calculus, it's clear what you need to do. You need to shoot the 10 peasants and save hundreds of people and your own life. Your life may not matter, but you're going to save hundreds of other people if you'll simply kill those 10 people. Well, there's no question in my mind what the right thing to do there is. You take the gun and you shoot the banditos. There's no question that it would be morally inappropriate for me to participate in somebody else's evil in that way. It's just plain wrong. Years ago, there was this horrible movie based on a horrible moral dilemma called Sophie's Choice. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. There's a woman who, she's Jewish, I think. I think that's why she was captured by the Nazis. And she has two children. She has a young son and a young daughter. Both in her arms are, one may be walking, and another is a baby in the arms. And they're in this line, literally going to the gas chamber. And an SS officer, she gets the attention of this SS officer for some reason, I don't remember why, but she bugs him. So he plays this little game and says, I will, let's see, something like, you choose which of your children you want to live, and I will let you and that child live, and your other child will die. I mean, what a horrible, horrible thing to do. I mean, that is just raw, unadulterated evil that anyone would even think of such a scheme. The right thing, it seems to me, for her to do would have had the courage to face into the, to see the evil of what's being asked her, to face into the, to that evil and say, I am not going to participate in your evil scheme. If you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me. If you're going to kill my children, you're going to kill my children. That our blood is on your hands. That is your decision to make. But I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to participate in your evil in any way. It seems to me clearly the morally courageous thing to do. Now, I understand that somebody may not make that choice. It's very understandable that someone may fail to make that choice. But it seems to me clear enough that that's the choice that needs to be made. But by a consequentialist calculus, you can save two lives and only lose one. That's easy. I can count. That's not the biblical perspective. It's not about saving lives. It's not about saving us from harm. It's not about saving us from pain. It's about going toward what's good, going toward what's right, and letting the chips fall where they will. I think that becomes important when we enter into the realm of sexual ethics, and we won't be able to explore it in depth tonight. But one of the reasons that we go so wrong in our thinking about sexual ethics is because we start looking at consequences rather than simply looking at the goodness or rightness of an act in its own right. Which is not to say that we can see the goodness or rightness of an act apart from consequences. Consequences are a part of what we are looking at when we judge an act good or right. That's true. But not in the way that the consequentialist measures it. And I'm not sure that I can even analyze the difference, but it's important that we recognize that there is a difference. Okay. Biblical sexual ethics, it seems to me, can only be determined in the context of a biblical theory of human sexuality, and that we've explored over the last several weeks, and particularly last week when we looked at what I called a biblical theory of sexual intimacy. We have to understand sexual ethics in the Bible in the context of that view of what sex is. It's this, and as you remember, I argued, it's this natural language that God has created, this language of our bodies, whereby with my body I can celebrate, ratify, declare, communicate, and otherwise convey to somebody I'm committed to for life that I am theirs and they are mine. It's a way of communicating what marriage is all about, communicating the marriage commitment in a very dramatic and poignant kind of way. And that's its fundamental purpose. That's what it's for in human experience. Okay, so with all that in mind as a background then, let me just suggest what I think are the cardinal virtues of biblical sexual ethics then. The first cardinal virtue is monogamous sexual intimacy. One woman, one man being sexually intimate with one another and no one else under and no other circumstances. Monogamous faithfulness. And the purpose, very simply, the purpose for that being considered to be right and good is that it's a way of having a kind of integrity. I am what I say with my body, I am living out through my actions in everyday ordinary experience in life. If I say with my body that I am yours, then I strive in my life to be for my wife. Now, it's not to say that I don't fail in terms of the ideal of what a marriage commitment is. Yes, I fail. I'm selfish, I'm unkind, I'm impatient. I fail in all kinds of ways to be the kind of husband to my wife that God would want me to be, but not for lack of trying. And I'm not failing by going to another. I may not be the husband that I need to be to my wife, but at least I'm a husband only to her. And I'm not pretending to be relating to any other woman in the same way, making the same sorts of promises and having the same kind of relationship with her, with another woman. I am committed to that being my life partner. So, in other words, the thing that's wrong with adultery is that it is a lie. I'm lying. Now, and I'll say the same thing about fornication, premarital sex, extramarital sex of any kind, is I am lying with my body. I might have said this last week, I don't remember, but let me repeat it. I'm afraid that if I were you, my response might very well be, oh, is that all? You mean it's no worse than a lie? Well, two things to say about that. One, yes, that is what I'm saying. Adultery and fornication is no worse than lying to somebody. But you're lying to someone in a particularly dramatically vicious way. Because you're lying to someone about something that goes really, really deep into their psyche. We all long to be special, to have this relationship of being special to another human being, to feel the security of that, to feel the warmth of that, to feel the satisfaction of having a relationship where that person is for me and only for me. That person accepts me, that person respects me, that person knows me, I can be free with that person, I can communicate with that person, I can tell them anything and it doesn't put them off and they don't walk away from me and they don't run away from me. We all long to have the security of that kind of relationship. And in sexual intimacy, that's what we are promising to the other person. Whether we intend it or not, or purpose it or not, as I said last week, is beside the point. That is what we are saying. It's built in. That's what it means, and we can't change that. So we have someone say with their body, you are the most special person in the world, and I will spend the rest of my life getting to know you, and study you, and understand you, and respect you, and accept you. And then we walk away. I mean, the mind-bending, soul-wrenching pain of that is one of the most cruel deceptions that anybody could inflict on another person. So yes, we're only lying, but what we're lying about and what we're playing with in the other person is goes really deep, and the wound goes really deep. So, yes, we're only lying, but this is a big lie on the one hand. And then secondly, only lying. That comes into what I was talking about earlier, about with God, light is light and darkness is darkness. And we repudiate all of the darkness. We don't tolerate any of it. As James puts it, he's the father of lights in whom there is not, how do you translate it? A shade of deviation, something like that. He doesn't deviate from light one bit. He doesn't tolerate any darkness. That needs to be the standard, the ideal, the goal that we seek to emulate. We should be a lot more outraged by lying than we are. We should be people who, in everyday interaction with just our words, let alone our bodies, but with just our words, our yes should be yes and our no should be no. We should be incredibly straightforward, incredibly open, transparent people who have no guile, have no deception, have no desire to deceive one another. Now, I know that's not true of us, but it ought to be. And it ought to be something that we seek to emulate more and more. If that's true in the ordinary, everyday communication with words in our lives, it's all the more true with what we say with our bodies. Okay, so adultery, fornication, anything that makes sexuality something that I practice outside the context of marriage is wrong from a biblical perspective. Now, we'll talk more about this, but I'm sure as the quarter goes on and when we get into winter quarter, I mentioned last week that what do I mean by sexuality? What exactly is wrong outside of marriage? Well, any kind of sexual intimacy, and last week I refused to define sexual intimacy, and I said you already know what it is. It's that which that you do that if somebody were doing that to your wife or your husband, you would have this rightful sense of jealousy about it. Or if somebody were doing that to your sister or brother, you would recognize that they are being sexually intimate. I mean, if you don't recognize it in your own case, then take it outside of your own case and ask, would I recognize this as sexual intimacy? I won't get into this tonight because we don't have the background for this, but I also think that there's a kind of sexual intimacy that is not physical in nature. It can be psychological, it can be emotional. There are also ways in which our affections can go outside of the relationship of the marriage relationship, where I may not touch another person, but it's still inappropriate. I'm still violating this commitment that I have with the other person. But we'll talk more about that later when we talk more about love and that sort of thing. Okay, so the first cardinal virtue is monogamous sexual intimacy. The second one, for lack of a better word, I will call sexual purity. Any desire for perverse sexual behavior is wrong, and any engaging in perverse sexual behavior is wrong. And that doesn't make any difference whether it's inside or outside the bonds of marriage. I know beginning in the 60s, you began to have Christian sex manuals, basically, come on the market. And there was a tendency for those Christians to have been products of their own culture, in that if they didn't come right out and say it, they tended toward the perspective that inside marriage, anything goes. I don't think that's right. I think there is such a thing as perverse sexual behavior, and I would argue that what defines perverse sexual behavior is any sexual behavior which mistakes the primary purpose of sexual intimacy and replaces it with some other purpose as of primary importance. Now, there's a lot of different mistakes we can make. Some of them shouldn't be called perverse, but by definition they would be. Usually, what we do is we make sensuality the purpose of sexuality. Or we make pleasure the purpose of sexuality, and therefore this thing that I might call sensuality is wrong. To turn sexual pleasure into merely sexual intercourse, sexual intimacy into merely an occasion of pleasure or a gourmet's delight of sexual pleasure is, I think, a perversion of God's intent. married people in our society feel a whole lot of pressure, it seems to me, because they are surrounded by images and messages of every kind that you're really not being satisfied and fulfilled sexually unless you have explored all the sexual possibilities. Well, there's a certain amount of freedom within the context of marriage, certainly. Pleasure is a part of sexuality. There's no question about that. God made it pleasurable. He intended it to be pleasurable. He intended it to be a serendipitous delight. But it's not its purpose. Its purpose is to be the language whereby husband and wife can communicate to one another the reality of their commitment to one another. And give one another the emotionally satisfying message that you're mine and I'm yours. That's its primary purpose. And the problem that we face in our culture is, how do I describe it? The kind of discontent and dissatisfaction that can creep in when a person is sent the message that you're really missing out. If you haven't had sex with five people at the same time, boy, you don't know what kind of rush that can be. Or if you haven't done this other kinky thing that you never would have thought of if I hadn't told you. The adrenaline rushes that you can have that you have never experienced because you haven't explored, you haven't been adventurous, you haven't gone after it, you haven't been brave enough. All of that is a diabolical lie. We can live a long time without any of those adrenaline rushes and be perfectly fulfilled as human beings. Completely and totally satisfied as human beings. Because that's not what our life is all about. I mean, you get the same perverse kind of thing. I mean, if you want to put it in another context, it becomes really clear that it's wrong. I imagine torturing another person, if you have the right sort of twisted psyche, can be a real rush. But is it a rush that we should have? Is it a rush that any decent human being should have? Of course not. Of course it's ugly. Of course it's perverse. Of course it's twisted. To eat another human being for Jeffrey Dahmer's is probably some kind of weird kind of pleasant experience. But does the pleasantness of it, the pleasure of it, whatever that is, make it okay? Well, of course not. It's disgusting. So we have to preserve and maintain a distinction between being sexually free with one another, on the one hand, within the context of marriage, and just simply gravitating toward what's disgusting. We live in a culture that's not going to help us there. And once you go down the path of deciding that sex is about pleasure, pure and simple, and maximizing your pleasure, then much like drugs, you need to get a harder and a harder drug. It needs to get more and more perverse, kinkier and kinkier, more and more twisted, in order for it to have the same effect. We have to decide not to go down that road at all, and to simply learn to be content with the pleasures of sexuality that are given to me serendipitously by my Creator. If they're there, they're there. If they're not there, then oh well. It's not what life is all about anyway. But whatever sexual intimacy we have, whatever it is like, it is still this language that is a meaningful language between husband and wife. It seems to me that what's happening today with the proliferation of prostitution, it's confusing. I think it's particularly confusing to women because it may seem like pornography. Did I say prostitution? Mm-hmm. Pornography is a kind of is a form of adultery, but I don't think that's right. It's not about lying to another person. I mean, that's just a picture. It's just an image. It's fantasy. There's no reality to it. I'm not lying to another person, nor even breaking my vow to my wife. But I'm deep into sensuality. It is nonetheless evil, even though it is not adulterous. But I don't think it's adultery. A whole other thing is happening there. It's pursuing the pleasure of sex for the sake of the pleasure of sex, without understanding its real purpose, sexuality's purpose, and honoring that purpose. Okay, hi. We can explore some other aspects of that later if you want in your questions. But that the second one is sexual purity. And I'm defining... Let's see. Wait a minute. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, Okay. Third cardinal virtue is what I will call sexual normalcy. Behaving sexually in a manner that is fully consistent with the purposes of God for marriage and sexuality. That is, what understanding what role marriage plays and what understanding what role sexuality plays within marriage, and living in a manner and having attitudes and behavior that's consistent with that is what I'm calling sexual normalcy. It's closely related to the last one, but in what I'm calling sexual purity, we're understanding the purpose and honoring the purpose of sexual intimacy itself. This is honoring the purpose of marriage and sexuality together. Three things that come to mind, and there are probably more, but it seems to me that rejecting procreation is wrong. If I just simply reject the procreative dimension to sex and sexuality, then there's something that I'm rebelling against what God has put together. And what God has joined, let no man put asunder. God has put together procreation and sexuality. I'm not taking the position that the Roman Catholics do, which is to say all birth control is wrong. Any attempt to manage and control the procreative results of sexuality, that any attempt at that whatsoever is wrong. I think that's unnecessary. Because this is more attitudinal than it is behavioral. That is, what is my attitude? What is my perspective? Do I want procreation to be a possibility in sexuality? If you use procreation and find out that pregnancy has occurred and you go, damn, then your attitude was not right. If you use procreation and it didn't work and a pregnancy results, and your perspective is God has had other ideas and he's giving us a gift, this is a gift from God, then my attitude has been to gratefully accept from God whatever he gives. But for me to simply reject altogether and renounce procreation as something I will not accept, I will not take it, I don't want it, get it out of my life, God, I won't have anything to do with it, then we're simply saying, God, you didn't know what you were doing when you made the possibility that I be a parent. And I refuse to accept it. That's wrong, it seems to me. Homosexuality is wrong, is a violation of what I'm calling sexual normalcy, because I think it rejects the clear purpose that God had in mind to have the marital relationship be between a man and a woman. Human beings who are profoundly and strikingly different from one another, so that the marriage is a commitment of mutual commitment to know one another across this important difference. I argued before that something can be obviously and transparently a violation of God's purpose and hence of his created order, even though it's not at all obvious how to articulate exactly how and why it's a violation. And I think that's the case with homosexuality. That's why so many Christians are confused today, because they won't honor their intuitions. They won't honor their perceptions that are obvious to them. Someone comes along and says, well, give me an argument. You know, make an argument against homosexuality. If you can't make an argument against homosexuality, you have no right to reject it. Well, there's all kinds of things we can't make an argument against, but we know they're wrong. In fact, there are all kinds of things that we know are wrong that philosophers have made arguments for. They're doing that all the time. They're cranking those articles out all the time. But it goes against all of our common sense. It goes against all of our ordinary perceptions. And yet, we are very clever with our minds to be able to create plausible, specious arguments in defense of things that are indefensible. Well, our anatomy, sociology, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming, but it's incredibly difficult to articulate into any kind of finely honed, irrefutable argument. much like, as I was talking to the Gutenberg students, much like the existence of God. Our intuition that God exists takes in all kinds of information, all kinds of data, all kinds of evidence. And we can know that God exists at a sort of intuitive level, even though to analyze that intuition into a formal philosophical proof is exceedingly difficult. It's been tried, and some attempts are a lot better than others, but every one of the attempts, the right kind of philosopher can find some inadequacies in the argument, and it needs to be patched, and then patched again to meet a new objection, and patched again to meet a new objection, and it can look like, you're just trying to patch a leaky boat. You don't have a good argument there at all. But on the contrary, there are all kinds of things that we know, and we know instinctively, even though we can't formulate a very, very airtight argument in either against something that it needs to be opposed or for something that we should be for. I think that's the case with homosexuality. I really don't think there's any question. That's how Paul presents it in Romans 1, is that it's so clearly against nature. That's why it's such an example of our depraved mind. It's such an example of our rebellion that we could be so obviously in conflict with something that is so obviously right. And yet, we, as evil human beings in rebellion against God, find a way to do it. And another one just like that is incest. All of mankind has known that incest is wrong, but tried to articulate an argument against it. I had a philosophy professor when I was an undergraduate back in the 60s who made his reputation on arguing for the advantages of incest or the moral rectitude of incest. Yeah, you can make the argument, but we all know it's wrong. So, sexual normalcy is the third pillar. The fourth one, and final one here, is self-control, self-mastery. And again, both within marriage and outside of marriage. Sort of embarrassed to admit this, and I probably wouldn't have acknowledged this out loud at the time, but I think in my early 20s when I got married, my perspective on marriage was, I have been exercising self-control for 20 years, and now it's time to not have to do that anymore. That within marriage, it was sex on demand, and I didn't need to control, master my own impulses, master my own desires any longer. That would be heaven. That's the Muslim heaven, isn't it? Where you no longer have to exercise self-control any longer. Not so. That's just simply our lot in life, is that we have more passions than we have opportunities to rightly and justly fulfill those passions. That's just simply always going to be true in our lives, whether it comes to food or sexuality or any number of things. Sometimes I just need to say no to myself and my desires because my priority is to do what's right by somebody else. And I can't do both, can't have what I want and do right by somebody else. The thing that people misunderstand about the Bible in this regard is that they mistake self-control and self-mastery with asceticism. Not aestheticism, like what the monks do. That's not the biblical virtue. The biblical virtue is not to deny your sexual desires because they're dirty or because they're yucky or because they're not spiritual, because they're not godly somehow. They're tainted, they're corrupting. That's not the biblical perspective. On the contrary, at the right time, at the right place, in the right context, sexual intimacy is a wonderful gift from God that fulfills a wonderful purpose. And the fact that it is physical, and the fact that it brings me face to face with my animality to a certain extent, my kinship to the animals, none of that negates the fact that it is a good thing, not a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing, not an evil thing. I'm not corrupted by it. I'm not defiled by it. It is sanctified. It is holy, however physical it might be. That's the biblical perspective. But however holy sexuality might be, it's when it's consistent with what is loving, with what is true, with what is right, and all the other ethical virtues that we talked about, it's consistent with those things. Asceticism is denying the physicality of sex just to deny the physicality of sex. If you could spend your whole life without any sex whatsoever, you would be a holier person because you'd be undefiled by this physical stuff. It's not the biblical perspective. In fact, Paul flat out rejects that in the middle chapters of 1 Corinthians. He flat out rejects that view and argues against it. In fact, we saw him arguing against that in the passage we looked at last week to a certain extent. On the one hand. But on the other hand, the biblical perspective is not that any physical desire, because it's a physical desire, is right and proper to fulfill whenever I want to. I mean, the Greeks were right in that regard. Plato was right in that regard. That my mind, my will, my spirit, the spiritual being that I am, the moral being that I am, has to take control of me. I have to be committed to what's good and right and noble, and not allow my desires to dictate my actions. Not allow my physical desires to dictate my actions. That's consistent with the biblical perspective. So I must exercise self-control. So for that reason, I think any kind of sexuality in the context of marriage that is selfish or insensitive or exploitive in any way is wrong. It must be oriented toward the other and not toward me. It's not about self-gratification. It's about serving another person and mutually communicating with one another. And for the same reason, therefore, I think masturbation is wrong. I remember reading a book back in the 60s where this guy said that masturbation was God's gift to men. And basically, I think his argument was, it's a way of satisfying yourself sexually so that you didn't commit fornication or adultery when you couldn't have sex with a wife. I think that's what he meant by that. But I beg to differ. I have to disagree with that. What we need to seek to emulate is the kind of nobility that would allow me to master my passions, control my desires, and not act on a desire just because it's there. Kant, I'm sure this must have been a fairly common euphemism for masturbation, but in Kant's Ethics, this is where I first encountered it, in the philosopher Immanuel Kant, in his ethical system. When he's talking about masturbation, he calls it self-abuse. That's the euphemism they use for it. And I got to thinking about, you know, that. At first, that struck me as sort of an odd thing to call it. But I hearkened back on all the times that I have been counseling people who have been tortured and tormented in their life because of their battle with masturbation. They're just tormented by it. And, you know, why are they tormented? I mean, there's lots of sins in our lives that are habitual, that are, you know, if I lie a lot, I mean, deceive people a lot, I'm capable of bending the truth a lot, that can be habitual, and I do it over and over and over again. Or I make sarcastic, cutting remarks, and it's just my style, and I do it over and over and over again. It's habitual, it's a besetting sin, I can't get control of it, it's just always there, it's always a battle, it's always a struggle. But I've never had someone be tormented and tortured by that in the same way that they are by masturbation. Now, why? Well, I think the reason, and I think that's behind what someone like Kant means when he calls it self-abuse, is because it is so degrading. And what I mean by that is, not because it's physical, not because it's sexuality, and I'm not backing up from what I said a second ago, but when I can't control my own impulses, I treat myself and I behave and I become like an animal. And we feel the defilement of being merely a beast, of being merely physical, of being merely a bundle of passions, and not a moral being who can rise above their passions and control our own passions. And so, in term, it, my self-beating, I'm sorry, self-beating, my self-image takes a beating in a situation like that. What am I? Am I animal or am I a human being? I mean, am I animal or am I angel? Am I animal or am I made in the image of God with the nobility of being able to do what's right and good and not be simply a slave of my own passions? And the toll that it takes on our self-image, I think, is where the abuse comes in. That's where the torment comes in. That's where the torture comes in. Okay, let me stop there and open it up to your comments or questions.
Yeah, you used the word serendipitous a couple of times, and I wasn't sure how you were using that. So could you explain?
An unexpected little delight that I didn't purpose or plan for. It just sort of happens. Isn't that a serendipity?
Last week, there was a show on TV that, as some of us were watching it at my house, it reminded me well of what you said last week and what you said this week. If anybody watched the last show of The Bachelor, they had the two girls, and the bachelor had to choose between the two of them. The one who lost was just devastated. She was tormented. She was in tears, and she thought there was a commitment. She thought there was, you know, that he was the one. She was convinced he was the one for her because of the way he treated her. And it was just it was gut-wrenching for me and my family to watch, just to see. I mean, I kind of suspected that was what was going to happen. I was curious to see if that was going to happen. And sure enough, it was just perfect for what you're saying, that commitment that somebody can create with their body, with their words, with their eyes, with everything. Just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was also struck when you were talking about sexual purity that you were talking about the role of sensuality and how we get that mixed up with the purpose for our sexuality. And it seems to me that that's so much of what our culture has done, that sexuality has been turned into a drug. And if I use my sexuality like a drug, then it's going to be all about not being vulnerable, because drugs are about hiding. But the actual purpose for our sexuality is about being vulnerable
and self-revealing.
Self-revealing with this person that I've made this huge commitment to. And that seems like a real integral part of that expression of sexual purity, as opposed to sensuality.
It's about
being vulnerable.
Yeah, good point.
I was a little surprised to hear you say that pornography was not adultery, or you wouldn't equate the two. And I understand the part about that you're not lying to anyone. You know, it's just a picture. But if it's within a marriage, if the husband, for example, is involved in pornography, is he not lying to his wife in some way by being involved in that? Or isn't he betraying her in some way?
Maybe in some way. I hesitate there to say no, because the point I'm making in making the distinction is it's one thing to use my body to say to another woman, not my wife, I'm yours. I have lied to my wife because I've already told her that I'm yours, and now, you know, what does it mean to be going and telling another woman that I'm yours? So I'm lying to my wife, and I'm lying to the other woman. So I'm lying with my body. What I have in mind in pornography is that it's not like there's another person out there who's hearing me say to them, I'm yours, as they would be with a mistress. So I'm not deceiving some other woman out there. Am I deceiving my wife? Well, not like I am in adultery, because I, again, it's not that I've promised myself to somebody else and not my wife. Something else is going on there. And is it a kind of betrayal? Yeah, it is a kind of betrayal, because what I've done is I've taken my sexuality that was meant to be this language to use in communicating with my wife, and I've turned it into something else. So yes, there's a sort of betrayal there, I think, but it's not the betrayal of unfaithfulness. It's a different kind of betrayal. Is that clear?
Yeah. Adding to that then, how does that perspective fit in with the idea that if you look on a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery?
I don't think Jesus was doing ethics there when he made that claim. What he was doing was... See, what was the issue there? The issue was you had a group of self-righteous Pharisees who, as long as they weren't having sexual relations with women that they weren't married to, were patting themselves on the back and saying, I'm a godly man. There's nothing ungodly about me. I'm righteous. And what Jesus is doing is saying to them, I don't think so. this whole concept you have of yourself as being righteous, it ain't right. Because you are driven by the passions, the desires, the commitments, every bit as much as the adulterer is. It's just that you keep it all legal. Your way of managing your perverse desires is when you get tired of one wife, you give her a legal divorce and go marry another one. And then when you get tired of her, you divorce her legally and go marry another one. And Jesus is finding a very difficult time finding anything significantly different with respect to how I view myself, as godly or not, between the out-and-out adulterer and the serial marriages. He's saying the same thing is driving both of them. You're evil. But in terms of analyzing what exactly is the evil of the evil, I just don't think he's addressing that issue. So I think, strictly speaking, he didn't mean to say that lusting after a woman is the moral equivalent of adultery. It's only the moral equivalent in the sense that it is equally a symptom of evil in your heart, equally a symptom of your own brokenness and unrighteousness. I think that was the point he was making. I mean, just think in terms of the consequences. If I lust after a woman in my heart, I don't leave behind a bunch of broken hearts and broken people in the same way I do if I act it out. There is a significantly different impact on my world by acting it out from desiring it. But Jesus' point is, to even have those desires means there's something wrong in you. So don't think that just because you've found a way to not act it out that you've somehow attained to righteousness. Because righteousness, if it's genuine and authentic, will go deeper than just your actions. It will affect your very desires.
Could you address the issue of sexual purity in regards to our movie watching habits, since that's a big deal in our culture? And both with regard to, I mean, there's obviously some movies that we would just look at and go, you know, I'm not going to watch that. That's obviously over the top. But even just, I mean, sex is such a topic within movies nowadays. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think in the kingdom of God there will be no R-rated movies. Of course, there won't be marriage or giving in marriage or sexuality either, so... in the kingdom of God, if it were like this world, there would be no R-rated movies. In an ideal world, we just wouldn't do that. It's the intimacy between two people is a sacred conversation. It's a holy conversation that should be between the two of them. You shouldn't have spectators to it. Now, the reason we enjoy it is because of the sensuality of it. It It's provocative. It incites us. It provokes desires in us. And the provoking of desires is pleasurable, is pleasant, is interesting. And that's what attracts us to it. At the very least, if it's not wrong that we expose ourselves to it, at the very least, it is dangerous. I mean, I can remember early in our marriage, actually lyrics to songs can do the same thing for me. They're portraying a certain sexual experience through their art that far surpasses anything that real sex can usually attain to, that real sex rarely attains. Why? Well, for one thing, look at all the advantages they have. They have the filtered lenses, they have the 64-piece orchestra, they have the, in Dolby sound, nonetheless. I mean, they have all this sensual input that is contributing to the impression of what an incredibly wonderful, powerful experience this is. Well, my wife and I didn't have powerful experiences, we just had sex. And it took me a long time to sort that out and realize I wasn't being cheated by reality. I was being lied to by the movie. The movie was creating a fantasy of something that never would become reality. And you know, I couldn't become content until I could convince myself that reality was reality. And fortunately, by God's grace, I think I'm learning to be content with reality in all kinds of areas of my life. What choice do I have? I mean, I need to be content with reality and not try to escape reality and live in some fantasy world. So the biggest danger of the movies, I think, are these really incredibly powerful lies they tell us that have the ultimate effect of making us discontent with our lives.
What about,
so they're at least dangerous.
What about something that is trying to paint a realistic picture, not creating that overhyped sort of thing, but is there something inherently sort of... is there something about a sexual relationship that is... I don't know. We talked a little about it when we read The Republic and Plato's arguments about how there's all sorts of things that you can't talk about in songs because it corrupts and all of that. And do you see movies being such, movies conveying, and song lyrics too, I mean, they convey ideas in a particular way, and in particular with a movie where there are actual people there. Do you think it's an appropriate venue for conveying an appropriate view of looking at it? Like, would you make a movie of your talk tonight?
What you mean by that is there anything wrong with the subject matter of exploring sexual relationships in movies? And
well, I mean, obviously, I mean, there's both. There's treating it, and then there's, like, I mean, like, some movies would say... I mean, it's the analogous thing to gratuitous violence. Someone would say with, like, say, Saving Private Ryan, they would say, it's not gratuitous, he's using it for a good reason. Or someone can make a like analogy, there's sex in this movie that's just as explicit as maybe some other movie, but it's for a good reason. It's for the purpose of showing how harmful adultery is or something like that.
Okay, well, I find it really hard to believe that the reason the explicit nature of the sexual scenes that we see in movies are there to make a point. Because any point that they're wanting to make can be made by innuendo and by inference. I mean, if you know they had sex together, you know they had sex together. Do I need to watch it for 5 minutes to really make the point? I'm not an artist, maybe I'm missing something, but I know the reason I'm attracted to it is because of the sensuality of it and how that tugs at me. That's why, and I think that's why they put it there, is because they want people like me to want to watch the movies with scenes like that in it and pay the bucks to go to a movie because it has scenes like that in it. And I find it very difficult to believe that it's there for any other reason than that. So is it wrong for me to be exposed to it? I don't know about that. It's dangerous, and I need to critique the images. I need to know when I'm being lied to. I need to remind myself that I'm being lied to, and I need to resist the lie and not allow myself to accept the lie, to be content with reality and resist the lie. At the very minimum, I need to do that. I think in an ideal world, you wouldn't be able to find actors and actresses who would portray that on the screen. I mean, I have more of a moral problem with what they're doing than what you all would be doing in watching it, in terms of just the sheer morality of it. But it's dangerous for us, and that at a very minimum, we need to recognize that. But lyrics are the same way, and there's something else going on there. That's not, no one is being explicit. But, I'd be driving down the road, and there'd be this woman in this really, really sultry voice singing to some man about how she can't stand to be away from his body. And I'd go home and Jody'd say, "Hi, Jack." But what about my body? it's a real, if we let those lies get to us, they are very, very, they undermine our contentment with the world.
I appreciate what you said about, in a marriage relationship, what sexuality is as opposed to the sensuality of it. Recently, I had such a vivid picture of that. I had a patient that came to see me for breastfeeding problems. Hopefully, all of you are right with this topic. And it was her second child. She had breastfed her first one. Second baby was new husband, younger than her. And he had not liked the look of her body, so insisted that she get breast implants. Had this baby, and the baby was unable to feed because of this alteration to her body. And what took place in my office was the most empty experience between a husband and wife I've ever seen. Because it was this man that, because of his sensuality and his desire for that, totally shut off this woman's natural design for what her body was all capable of doing. And I've never in all my years of doing this ever seen a woman that was so completely empty and unloved. And that's what our society tells exactly. Men and women that they deserve. And it's tragic. I mean, it was so important in our home that we raised our children that bodies age and that there's beauty in that. And I mean, and when you talk about this tonight, I mean, it can be so, we can go over it so quickly. The true importance of what that communication is profound. Mm-hmm. And it gets so ruined, in our world. I'm just so thankful that you talk about it the way you do.
And we mustn't underestimate how powerful the lies that are being told us are, that it's saying, they would say to me, I mean, the culture would say to me, "Oh, that's great, Jack. Yeah, that's communication and all that kind of stuff. But boy, is it sensuality too. And we can have them both." Well, no, not really. For exactly the reasons that you're describing, is because reality is such that we get older. What am I? Do I cash in my wife for a younger model just because it's not the same any longer? That doesn't make any sense. And yet, that would make sense to our culture. Or I'll change my body and make it younger, as the case may be, because that's what it's all about. That's a huge, powerful lie that is affecting all of us, and we just have to resist it.
You know, going back to the previous request for you to comment on movies, mm-hmm. and also maybe even on pornography, could we possibly go to the scripture that says that whatever is good, whatever is of good report, whatever is true, whatever is, you know, worthy, to kind of direct our minds to think on these things?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So in that sense, that's kind of a guideline that's already been set out in the scripture, that if we have a problem with something, if it causes us to have our thoughts be directed in other than those directions, that maybe it's not good mm-hmm. to go to those movies. It's not good to pick up that copy of that magazine that would take us down the wrong path, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Maybe you could just comment on that.
Okay. I think that's true. The problem is that in some aspects of Christian culture, I think they misconstrue what the danger is. And I mean, I know I did in being raised in the Christian home. For the longest time, my sense was that I'll never forget. When I went away to college, I worked in a store in the student union, and they had everything from toothpaste to cigars to yogurt to Playboys. And my job at times was to go and stock the shelves. And I, for the most part, having been raised the way I was raised and being a good Christian kid, would not open the Playboy. But there was a guy who works with me who would lay out the centerfold on the table back while he was working on it. And so I'll never forget the first time I walked in, and there I was confronted with a centerfold. And of course it was I don't know if you understand the impact of the visual confrontation with the female body by the part of a male, but it's powerful. I mean, it just, and this was the first time I had ever seen a naked female body like that. So it was just a powerful, visceral experience. But combined with it, because of my background, was also this sense of defilement that came on me. Because my view was, it's as if my exposure to this thing that it was inappropriate that I'd be exposed to, you know, there were defilement rays that were striking me and defiling me. And I think all too often that's the view that we Christians have, and so we get hysterical about this kind of thing. I mean, that what we need to do is to avoid it, to put, you know, moats and hedges and all kinds of things between me and anything that might be inappropriate, because I want to, you know, lead, kryptonite, I mean, all kinds of stuff to filter out the defilement rays. When in fact, okay, it happened. Now I have to deal with it. The important thing is, how do I deal with it? And that is, you have a choice there. I was too young to even, I mean, I didn't have a choice. I just was freaked. But later, when I got older, I recognized the choice. I can see it for the lie that it is, and can therefore, for lack of a better word, meditate, put my mind on, let my mind go to reality, to truth. Or I can say, well, what would be wrong with kind of fantasizing that the world were different than it actually is? Let me play with that. Let me dwell there. Let me live there. Let me like that. Let me enjoy this fantasy world that has been created for me, rather than reminding myself of the real world that really exists. That, I think, is what Paul's talking about. It's not, don't you ever see a naked lady that's not your wife. Rather, it's gravitate toward truth, love the truth, embrace the truth, embrace the reality that God made, and run from the lies and the myths and the deceptions. Don't let your mind dwell there. Make your whole outlook on everything informed by what's true and what's good.
You know, today, as I think, as parents, we are presented with a real difficulty in raising, particularly in raising sons, I have three sons, and the images that are presented to them everywhere they turn,
yeah.
You know, from commercials on television that flash before them to billboards when you drive down the street to the underwear ads in, you know, on the back page of the newspaper,
right.
You know, it's everywhere, and trying to raise young men who have a sense for the importance of purity and to pursue the right things when all the images that are before them are contrary to
right.
that, it presents a real challenge.
No, absolutely. I'm glad I'm as old as I am in the world that we live in today and know what I know. And I think the only antidote that we can give is to make sense out of what sexuality is and what it's for. And they'll either believe it or they won't believe it. But we're not exactly helping them if I slap my hand over their eyes every time, you know, that there's a nearly naked lady, because that's not helping them. What do they do with that other than that was more the environment that I grew up in. And all it did is make me afraid, really. It didn't inform me. It didn't educate me. It didn't fortify me to meet the world. It just made me afraid. And I had to learn on my own. I had to figure this stuff out on my own. And I think what we really need to do to fortify our young sons is to teach them, help them understand what it is, what it is not. You don't need to be afraid of it. It's a reality. It's what God created. It's good. But here's what it's for.
I was thinking that as you're talking about the vulnerability of men to pornography, I just want to kind of raise that I think there's equal lies that are attractive to women that are very much portrayed in movies and in a lot of romantic comedies
right.
are much more seductive for women
right.
in terms of just the principle that you're talking about, that we're encouraged to believe a lie about what relationships look like.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we'll be... Somebody, maybe even you, will be talking about that.
Oh, okay.
Next part.
Oh, yeah.
No, but that's a good point. Very good point.
I'd like to ask a question about the matter of contraceptives.
Okay.
We're in a young church with a lot of young marrieds, and we have a lot of babies. We've remodeled the nursery, and I don't think it's going to be adequate, but as a result, there's been a lot of discussion about contraceptives as a result of that. And I don't have a good grasp on the Catholic perspective, but having read the Pope's encyclical, I think from 1965 or sometime in there, and some reflection on that since then, it seems as if they were saying that you can't use mechanical means to avoid contraceptive or to avoid contraception and still maintain the same attitude toward procreation. They argued that it leads to the very thing that we see in our culture, promiscuity, abortion, and so forth, because it changes the whole nature of what the sexual relationship is, and that was apparently fundamentally what their rationale was for the idea that contraceptives must naturally lead us that way. Just so I appreciate your comments.
Yeah, I think that's a more recent position that you see among some thoughtful Roman Catholics. As I understand the origin of their view, it comes from basically seeing the purpose of sexuality as procreation. And that's where I'm in fundamental disagreement with them. Yes, God has put procreation and sexuality together, but it's not its purpose. That's the purpose of animal sexuality. I mean, it's really interesting in the biology of human sexuality. Male human beings are not only interested in female human beings when they're fertile. But in most of the animal kingdom, some of you biologists correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it only interesting when a dog is in heat or when when fertility is there? That's not true in human sexuality. Why? Because that's not the purpose of human sexuality. It's not merely procreation, its purpose is not procreation, period. That is an outcome that God has bound together with it. And it makes a ton of sense that he would do that, so that young human beings would come into this environment of a commitment between a man and a woman to one another and the security and the warmth of that environment. So it makes a ton of sense that it would go together, but it's not its purpose. Its purpose is the language of commitment between the two people. So in a childless marriage, they are not somehow abusing their sexuality. If they're being sexually intimate and no child is resulting, sexuality is still appropriate even if children don't come. So that's my disagreement with them. Now, I must say there is some sympathy that I have for the latter argument, more sophisticated argument, that there is a tendency in our culture, because of the technology that we have, to reinforce that separation of procreation from sexuality. That's a good point. I don't think that's a reason to call it immoral. I think that's just a reason to say we really need to work hard to remind ourselves of the truth and critique what it is that we're doing, understand what it is that we're doing.
Thank you.